Jai's Album Club. Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today. Obviously, we are all in this collective effort and we're all doing what we can. It's been a difficult time. We all hoped that it would come to this, but sadly, alas, JJ's Album Club is back for another series. Nobody wanted this to happen. I don't want to be saying this now, but they are back. We're going to do everything we can to make it a short series of episodes and get through this. Professor Chris Whitty.
Thank you, Boris. Yes, what I would like to just reiterate what the Premier has just said there. Unfortunately, we were hoping that there would be less podcasts coming out at the turn of 2021. And unfortunately, we've not been able to stop JJ's Album Club from returning, thus keeping the number quite high. So there really is nothing else that we can do other than reiterate all the advice that we've been giving you, which is to stay home, stay safe, keep downloading and listening to the podcast, rating it as well through on iTunes.
Please like and subscribe. It's so important to like and subscribe. Please.
And the quicker we can get these two guys away from the podcast realm, either by making them very successful or just completely their numbers going through the floor, then everybody can go back to their normal lives. And I hope that the public will stay with us on this and trust us when we say this really is the best thing you can do right now. Don't be tempted to not listen to the podcast. I know it's tempting, but please just make sure that you do what is right in these difficult times.
Thank you.
Everybody, and welcome to series 3 of JJ's Album Club. My name's Joey Page. He's Jimmy Femarewa. Welcome to the show.
Hello,
everybody.
Coming right, in hot. We are back, mate. We're absolutely back. And what do we do again? Is that it? That's it, right? We're done. Are we done?
That's it. See ya.
No, this is exciting. We're back. And we are back with a bang, sort of.
We're back with a huge explosion.
We really are. Right? Really bad at selling ourselves, but we really are. We legitimately are back with a bang.
We have upped our game. This is the new and improved JJ's Album Club. We took a bit of time off from Series 2. We've got the absolutely very best guests that we could find, like really great guests. We're so happy with everybody that we've got on this series. There's no mucking about. There's going to be some mucking about. Let us introduce ourselves if you're new to the podcast. My name's Joey Page. I'm a stand-up comedian, but most importantly, I'm a new and alternative music presenter. And also, let's not forget, I've got my own Twitch channel, of course. It's 2021. Of course I have. Jimmy, who are you?
My name is Jimmy Femarewa. I am a writer, podcaster, as you can hear. What else am I? I'm sort of probably best known for being a restaurant critic, occasionally being on the telly, on MasterChef, which I get really sort of weirded out by. But also I am a music journalist of quite a few years now. And we are really old friends, aren't we? And we meet up to talk about music and invite incredible guests on to introduce us to albums that are particularly meaningful or important to them. That is the podcast. That is what we do. Always good to explain.
That's the podcast in what should have been one sentence in nine sentences. And what I know Jimmy for is being one of my oldest friends from school. And so I've seen Jimmy at countless parties, and I can tell you that his pedigree of music knowledge is second to none. He will take over every single playlist, DJ deck, any kind of music situation. Absolutely. He's in there stirring the pot. I won't even go to a thing if I don't like the music. We are very well qualified to be here, even though us keep saying that we're very well qualified to be here, it makes it sound like we're not.
But that is beside the point. We should talk about our guests, but first of all, we genuinely haven't done this in a long time. What have you been listening to, Joe? Like, what have you been into? Because we used to check in quite a lot. Part of this show used to be that we would listen to the same albums and respond to it and sort of argue the toss over various what have you been listening to? What have you been on?
Well, I absolutely love the new Shame album. I think it's fantastic. They took a long time to make it, and I was a bit like, what's going to come back?
Yeah.
I was a bit worried. But they've pivoted. Like, we've all had to pivot a bit, and it's a really brilliant album. I'm really, really excited for Goat Girl's new album. And also, I just found something today, and I'm really in love with it. It's just, well, one track that I've listened to. I don't really know hardly anything about it. They're called La Femme, and they are French, of like psych, trippy business, and a song called Cool Colorado, which came out last year. And I just found it when I was looking for something to play on my Twitch show today, and I was like, this is amazing. I've listened to it about 15 times today.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out. With you on Shame, definitely. What else have I been listening to? With the Shame thing related to that, I spent a large part of the week just kind of fantasizing about booking tickets for Shame in like Berlin in October. October will be all right, won't it?
Yeah, let's do it. I'll book some, because you can book hotels that give you free cancellation. Okay, I'll book a hotel.
Well,
Phil, I'll do it now.
Yeah.
Phil,
let's do it now.
We
need something to cling to, mate. Honestly, oh my God. God. Well, anyway, I think we should get straight on to our guest, because it's really exciting. Really exciting way to kick it off. And we recorded this quite a while ago.
Can I just say, we're recording this on Friday night. It's coming out. You're listening to it from Monday.
Yeah.
So it's either Monday now or it was Monday in the past. And as we sit on the Friday before the albums are announced, places where in the chart, the guy that we've got on the show today is scheduled for either number one or number two album in the album charts. It's huge.
We keep saying it's big. Do you believe us yet? I mean, yeah, we're recording sort of relatively close to this going out, but who knows what terrifying strains of the virus.
The chart won't blow up by Monday.
New terrifying strains of this hell plague have been announced. Who knows where the podcast,
where everybody loses the ability to download
anymore.
A podcast is one of the symptoms.
You know, if charts and albums are the mere relics of the world we knew. Yeah, exactly.
The weekend past.
But yeah, it's very exciting. And the person kicking off this glorious new age of JJ's Album Club is Jason Williamson of Sleaford Mods. Apparently so. he was incredible. It was an absolute joy.
Yeah, great chat just before Christmas. And really nice guy. Very straight talking, but very down to earth. And just a good laugh. I feel like that's the thing that runs through all of this so far. So far, everybody, as we've had a real good laugh chatting
it's been
to
really,
as well.
It's been really nice. I think people, just to like pull back the curtain slightly, you get the sense that people sit in front of a Zoom call. Celebrities, musicians are quite adept now at conducting Zoom interviews. They don't really know what they're in for, but everybody that we've spoken to has really got what we're trying to do with this podcast, and they've really sort of responded in kind and been really interesting and funny. And obviously we're all in this kind of shit pit together, so that's a bit of a nice leveler. But he was great. He was really he's quite surprising, isn't he? So I think maybe if you have, and I think I probably did have an image of him as, you know, the slightly a bit more like the caricature from his songs to a degree, but he's quite
a bit more abrasive. Because as well, I was in the Zoom, I set up all the Zoom, and he got there about 10 minutes early. I thought, well, I'm not going to leave him in the waiting room. So then I was like, oh, I've just got 10 minutes on my own with him. And then he was like,
tempted to do the accent, isn't it? But I've already had a word myself, because I thought, oh, he's probably going to listen back to this. So the last thing he wants to hear is us doing the voice. I'm sure he loves that. You know, like,
but
if you're...
He told me I had a nice Fred Perry, and I was like, right, this is okay. And then I was talking about, he asked me what I did. I said, obviously, I'm a stand-up comedian. And he said that his mate runs a comedy club in Nottingham, and his mate used to be my first agent.
You mentioned this. So, boom, we were in. So we were absolutely in. Yeah, fantastic.
And we're in, and we're away. And, yeah, like you said, so far all the artists have kind of got what we're trying to do with this. If you get what we're trying to do with this, then how about like... rate, subscribe, that kind of thing. That'd be great. You can follow us on social media. We're not hard to find.
Let's
get on with the episode. We should also say something that just didn't come up, so we didn't touch on it, was obviously, unfortunately, almost exactly a year ago, one of the people behind the album that Jason brought to talk to us about, Andrew Weatherall, passed away, sadly, and we didn't... It didn't really come up in the flow of the conversation. But obviously, we just wanted to acknowledge the sad passing of that almost a year ago.
I think we were talking about it and going off on tangents, we just didn't quite acknowledge that. But obviously, a lot's been written and a lot's been said about Andrew's incredible sort of legacy and influence as a musician.
And
completely.
Such a pioneer.
So, yeah, we just wanted to, like... mention that up front, because I think that in the sort of scramble to chat about his music and his work, we kind of neglected to mention that obviously he'd sadly passed away last year. But it's a great conversation, and it was awesome. Good to be back.
And one quick thing that I'm sure this podcast is not, you know, It's not going to make or break anybody, but we should say that Sleaford Mods' new album, I think is their best one. Definitely, I think, their most accessible one for the casual listener. Spare Rib, it's out now. It's been out exactly a week as we're chatting now. It's really, we've had the pleasure of listening to it since Christmas, and I've really had a good old go on it, and I think it's brilliant. So go and give that a listen, check it out. What about all that money that you're not using on travel? Why not go buy a copy of it?
That is very true. You're a big advocate for like properly getting vinyl, properly supporting musicians. As we speak, we're a day away from Glastonbury being cancelled, which is gonna, you know, have a real ripple effect on the festival circuit. God knows what's going to be left for us when we're definitely in Berlin later in the year. So yeah, definitely a time to try and support artists wherever you can. And I think that'll be a continued theme of the conversations that we have with people. Get out there, support music. Yeah. Fucking do it. I'm really sweary tonight.
And then when you're done with that, carry on supporting support podcasts. And then, but now, listen to this interview.
Podcasters. Here we go.
Anyway, it's a pleasure to be back. If you're new, there's also a back catalogue of ones that we've done in the past with some great musicians, so check them out as well. And we've got some great guests coming up over the coming weeks. So stick with us, tell people about it. But most importantly, enjoy this wonderful chat with Jason Williamson from Sleaford.
Do it.
JJ's Album Club.
I mean, the news is like, it's just too much. It's like comedy almost. It's like you're taking the piss. Yeah. Is someone in there just taking the piss? It's just disgusting.
Well, that's. I mean, it must just be great because there's so much, you know, as with me, there's just so much stuff to, like, go for.
Well, there's too much now. It's not for choice. So you could actually over-egg it. You know, there's so much. So you've got to be selective, definitely, and also be selective in how you say it, I guess. You know what I mean? I thought we were even pushing it by mentioning the pandemic on a couple of tunes and also the artwork, because the artwork's like, based around those daily briefings, you know, the colours. Yeah.
Is this for the new record?
The chevron on the stand.
Yeah. I was like, oh, we've fucking over-egged it here, you know. Nobody's going to want to know about this shit. You know,
well, that's really interesting. When did you sort of first, because, yeah, I've listened to the album, it's absolutely great. I only had a quick list, like, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. When was the decision made
and were you kind of in agreement that you'd kind of use this period both as kind of inspiration and try to get something out quickly that's kind of, you know, reacting to the situation as is, because, you know, it feels very fresh in that way. But as you say, there's a danger with these things dating within, you know, a couple of hours at the moment, aren't there?
I think so. There's that, and there's also the fact that, you know, the last thing you want is some fucking idiot that's just been able to afford to stay at home all year telling you about the fucking misery of the pandemic. But it's like, I think we had it planned anyway in January, well, last year, an album. So it was like January came, we did 5 tracks in January, then went to Australia, and that's when it all kicked off. So we got back and then we couldn't continue with any touring or whatever. So I just sat in the house and wrote tunes, you know, and a few of them started to talk about it. I was trying to resist it first because I just didn't know how to think about it, really, because it was just a bit weird, obviously. And then it started, the boredom started kicking in, the aggression, the anger, you know, queuing up at places and talking to people when you just can't be bothered, you know what I mean? And then when they started allowing people to go out again, this place was just infested with people in the park boozing. It's like, for fuck's sake. And you're getting all these, like, around here, like, sort of ex-hooligans, who I know a lot of them, just bare-chested, walking up like, fucking grow up. Fucking grow up. What are you going to do? Beat a kid up? So, it's like, Jesus. So, that all started seeping into the songs, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating... I think there's been a broader example of people just trying to fit their old lives into this new reality, isn't it? Like, people are kind of still trying to find ways to have fun and party and to drink and to behave in the same way, basically.
Yes,
which is quite fascinating. You mentioned the lack of live work there, obviously. I was wondering about the effect of that. Like, I mean, it seems like it's had a direct effect in terms of giving you the impetus to write more and to kind of produce this album. But, you know, I mean, this will be a little while after that, but obviously towards the tail end of last year, musicians speaking out about the loss of live work and how streaming just is like a drop in the ocean, like it's nothing for like smaller acts. And it was a real reality check for me, because I think you think, oh yeah, people are fine if they're, you know, nominated for a Mercury or whatever. But, and Joe can attest to this as somebody who's like a comedian and has been struggling through this time as well. But yeah, how have you kind of coped with not being able to gig, which was really your lifeblood for so long?
It's been all right, but it's like you just get used to gigging and checking into hotels. And I know I don't want to sound like a wanker, but you know what I mean, it's nice to get out of the ash, you know?
I can relate to that, mate. Oh my god, yeah.
I tell you what, I love airports as well. I fucking love it. Just hanging around an airport, oh, get a sandwich, oh, go and have a look in JD Sports, you know. Oh, look at that person over there, I wonder where they're from. You know, that kind of thing. It's like you miss all that, and it's like I got used to that, and it was like after years and years of mindlessly boring jobs and never leaving Nottingham or wherever I was living, this is great, you know. So I miss that, but I don't think it affected the recording as such, but it just those experiences that want to get out of the house and obviously to earn money.
How, like, to move away from like the pandemic and that, so to like talk about your process a bit and also your musical heritage before we get on to the album that we're going to talk about today. I'm really fascinated by your process as a writer. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, like, what's your method for coming up with the lyrics? Do you just kind of like go for a walk with your, with like a little notebook, or how do you tend to write, Jason?
Like wherever, whatever. It can be, you know, you're boiling the kettle and a couple of lines come to you. And that normally starts happening, I don't know, 6 months after you've given an album into the record label, you know what I mean? You need that cooling off period and then you start again. It can happen anyway, you know, like that. Or can, if I force myself to sit down, to be honest, that's when the best stuff comes, but it's just forcing yourself to sit down, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, because you can... Without sounding like a wanker, you know, because you can do it, it's like you're not that motivated to do it sometimes. you know what I mean? It's like, all right, whatever. But then when you sit down, it's like, oh right, okay, you know. But
like, obviously, one of the standout things about you is your ability to sort of pick these little bits out of life that no one else notices, but also like your turns of phrase and stuff. So would you say that that's just like a natural ability, like the way that you talk on a record, that just kind of a natural gift that you've got, or is it something that you work quite hard at?
I just like honed it over the last few years, you know what I mean? Over the, probably the last, since I started doing it way back in 2003, 2004. And I always used to like the sound of my own voice. not like in the pub, or you know, when you're just slagging anyone off, or generally negativity, which I found really, really quite interesting. And because that's all it was, all you do is just have a laugh and slag people off. That was life, you know what I mean? Day to day. So I really like the idea of that going onto a record, you know. Getting into rap and everything else and blah, 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 and punk, you know, all those things combined, you know what I mean? Transformed into what it is today.
Yeah. I saw an old interview with you in The Guardian, which was quite a nice one, actually, and you were talking about, like, Wu-Tang and Wella being quite informative kind of things that you wouldn't necessarily put together, but makes total sense in the context of you and Sleaford Mods. And I just wondered, what can you remember those when you were first introduced to say on the hip-hop side, like to Wu-Tang and those kind of those hip-hop
I was late to Wu-Tang Clan about 2003, and I was working in a warehouse and the geezer there used to play it all the time, and I just it suddenly dawned on me that it was absolutely magnificent. I mean, well, it wasn't even like, up until then, hip-hop was very disciplined to the beat. People were very disciplined. Rappers were very slick. Wu-Tang were just like a bunch of yoppos, and it was almost like they were shouting. And then you had this like incredible tragedy and pain, frustration, you know, and I connected with it, really did connect with it, you know what I mean? Even though, you know, I'm across the pond, you know what I mean? But it just struck me that there was something very valuable about that. And it was something that I wanted to try and do myself, but I became obsessed with the fact, well, how many would do that? I'm not going to rap like an American.
Was there ever a phase when you had a cold American accent? Did you ever like...
No. But you know what? But you rap, like, rappers around in knots, the young lads around here were just absolutely rinsing it. You know, like a US thing. It's like, well, you don't talk like that. So it's like, how do you do it? And I came to the conclusion that, well, these people are just talking in their own accent and they're saying what they want. They don't give a shit if people understand it or not. So I think I'll just do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how it started. And so, and that seemed to work, you know what I mean?
It is fascinating, that idea of you hearing sort of Wu-Tang, these like East Coast rappers, and sort of finding the sort of common ground in terms of what they were trying to say and what they were talking about. And I think there's like quite a lot of precedent for that with like even like Northern Soul, like all these kind of old industrial towns, and they were kind of loving the music of these East Coast industrial towns. And it was like, and I find that really fascinating, like throughout, that you can sort of find this common ground with people that are like thousands of miles away, like basically.
Yeah, I mean, but it was also, they weren't painting it in a, there wasn't any self-pity, you know. It was like these genius like bits where it was just recording someone walking in the door and going on about some bloke being shot down the road, you know. And then the more quickly forgetting about it in 2 seconds. I mean, that's just incredible. Yeah. I mean, obviously the person getting shot isn't, but you know what I mean? It was all a matter of fact type thing.
Yeah.
You know, lines like "scream on your ass like your dad," you know, that's just brilliant. Because your dad did just literally scream on your ass, didn't he? That's like, get back here. You know, for rappers to say that's just brilliant.
I wanted to ask about the new album, and like "Mork and Mindy" is such a great tune. Like, absolutely love that. And
thank you.
Is it like your very first collaboration with Billy Nomad? Because it sort of changes the formula. Yeah. And I wondered what the process was in terms of opening up to collaborations, changing the sound a little bit, because Sleaford Mods has always been, it seemed, quite, you know, minimalist. Like the focus is your voice and your perspective.
Yeah.
And I wondered what the conversations were like between you and Andrew about how far you could move it and still keep it as a Sleaford Mods song.
Yeah, we were kind of, before the album was, before we even started thinking about it, we had a meeting with Rough Trade, and they were like, you know, we talked about producers and stuff, and it just, the sheer horror that fell down Andrew's face is like, it's like...
What, like flying you right, over to Rick Rubin wouldn't have worked.
Jesus Christ, no, I'm not having any of that. You know, it's like... But it's, oh, do we? Well, do we? No, we don't. You know, we're not a producer-led band. But we sat there and talked about collaborations. And that would be a way of pushing the production forward for what me and Andrew do with it. You know what I mean?
Was, because obviously you collaborated, as we said, with a couple of people that we've got on this series of the podcast, Baxter and Pan Am. And so, were those things that you just wanted to do? And I know, like, from speaking to Pan Am, like, the great mutual respect, and like, you got to know each other, and like, Baxter saying that he's learned a lot from you in terms of like his like showmanship on stage and invoking the character that he is something that he kind of almost was a bit in awe of from you, and then kind of worked out how to make that a bit better for himself. So it's not, I'm not saying this from a cynical point of view of like, did you do these collaborations to help you work out how to do a collaboration of your own? Or was it purely, I just wanted to work with these people and they asked me and I did it?
Yeah, I don't know. No, I think I just wanted to work with them because I've written Mork and Mindy. Me and Andrew wrote it on tour early 2019. And we had the lyrics for a rough version of the lyrics. We were just like, oh, we've got to record this, you know. It's brilliant. And then I came up with a chorus for it, but my voice just didn't sound great on it. And I've been listening to loads of old 80s soul again, you know what I mean? Like Luther, Alexander O'Neill, stuff like that. And some of the more commercial stuff, you know what I mean, that stuck with me as a kid. And, you know, I wanted to try and put that in it. And we've been trying to experiment with stuff like that before. And it kind of worked, but when we met Tor, she was, it was just quite obvious. She had a voice that reminded me of that. Mm. So almost like an 80s, I don't know, Sheena Easton or something. Do you know what I mean? So it's just I've got to get this in. Yeah, this is brilliant. Yeah. We've got to do this. No one's doing this. And so, so we got her in, you know, she agreed to do it. I collaborated with her on her debut album, done a tune with her. Awesome. Yeah. And we share the same manager as well. So it was like, all right. And she was like, I'll do it. And it took her about 20 minutes to do that, to record that. It was just amazing. we knew it was going to be a real strong tune.
It's sort of the interesting thing, I think, as well with collaborations and you guys is that, I think even Baxter talked about this, that kind of your image is that kind of you're quite like combative with like other bands. And obviously when you sort of first emerged, there was lots of like, there were lots of wars of words kind of happening and things like that. And it kind of seems like that isn't really true, that kind of that you've maybe been painted, even though you sort of are honest about acts. It's not like you're kind of out to get everyone, like you sort of don't want to work with other people, basically.
I am a bit bitter, I'll give you that.
Is it something you've had to sort of, that people have this misconception about you guys, that they're a bit kind of, I don't know, intimidated?
I think what does this say? Does that say something about us, or does it say something about the landscape, the current landscape, you know, where there isn't a lot of people, I just find it hard to get the truth out of people sometimes. Yeah. It's like the general consensus is everybody just gets on with everybody. Mm. And why, you know, why is that publicly they get on with everybody and why? Mm. Because it's obviously easier for them to operate in the industry if you're not burning bridges or if you're not jarring with the current mood or mindset, which is stupid, really. I mean, it's a fine line, I guess. You know, someone accused me of being a bully and I just thought, well, I'm not. But if they think I am, then that's pretty bad, isn't it? Really? Yeah. I mean, if that's how it's making them feel.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know. I mean, it's a fine line, isn't it?
I can confirm, because Jason's quite early on the Zoom call. We chatted for about 10 minutes and I felt bullied. It was taking the piss out of my beard. It's been a nightmare.
I couldn't help it, to be honest.
Yeah, you're within your rights. It's a terrible beard. But something else I wanted to ask you about before we kind of move towards chatting about the album was, like, your performance on stage, you commit to that so well, but as a performer, there obviously must be days where you don't feel like you've got that energy going into the gig or whatever. So how do you get yourself to that place that you can sort of nail that energy and that performance every time? Is it like, do you lean into the words that you've written and they kind of remind to give you the fuel, or like, do you have techniques? How do you basically get yourself in that perfect mind state each time, Jason?
Just go on. It's a bit like a gym session. You like, you get in there, and the days where you're a little bit knackered, you're like, oh, I can't be arsed. And then you get in there and you do two or three exercises and you're like, I'm all right. And then you get into it and before you know it, it's over, you know. And it can sometimes be a little bit monotonous. It can. But generally speaking, it's not. It's something that you just learn to engage with as soon as you get on stage. How's it going to be? Is it going to fall on its face? How many people are there? You know, all of that is quite exciting. And because it's literally nothing, really, just myself and Andrew and a laptop and a backing track, it's like, it could fall on its arse, couldn't it? Like, on paper, it's like, what? So it's up to you to recreate whatever you've put on record that people have come to see you for. And, that's a real challenge. I think that's great, you know.
And was it right that you had to kind of convince Andrew to kind of... It's become so iconic, like, your stage performance and the guys with him just standing at the laptop, like, and did he take some convincing to kind of to
talk
us through that?
Talk about a year, I think. It's like, no. Are you going to come down though? Yeah, I might do. So what he'd do is he'd give me the backing tracks on a CD and I'd put them in a CD player with a remote control. And I'd tell the person behind the PA at the gig, whatever gig I was playing, to obviously attach the CD player. And then I would work the tunes from the stage. So whenever a tune finished, I'd take the remote control out of the pocket and just press and it would go on to the next tune. And but I was like, look, you've got to come on stage, you know. No, I'm all right. And then we got this slot at this noise festival in Nottingham at this club. And it was loads of noise artists from all over Europe and the US. And we got quite a high placing because the album, first album had just come out. He agreed to do it because there was a lot of people on there he was influenced by.
Right.
And that's when it started.
Yeah.
And now is it like, have you almost created a monster? Has he become like a massive diva now?
Yeah.
No, he's all right. I mean, you know, he doesn't suffer fools, Andrew, and he gets quite short with people. And, you know, if he doesn't want to do something, he just won't do it. And, you know, that's how it is, you know what I mean? So, but no,
it's quite interesting that sort of in terms of the public facing image of the band or the group, like people might think that you're the one that's like the sort of, you know, screaming face, or no, he won't let anything pass. Yeah. And maybe Andrew's like the placid guy in the background.
No, I'm like the kiss ass fucking celebrity wanker. I'll do anything. I'll go and meet fucking Stork SB and like advertise some margarine or whatever. I'll do anything. I literally will go to the, what was it Liam said about Noel? He'd go to the opening of the Chris Packet. That's me. Andrew's not into it. He's not fazed by it. We even had to convince him to go on Jules Holland. He was like, I'm going to do that shit.
That's amazing.
I know. So, but yeah, you know, he gets on with it.
Now, obviously, for all the kind of, you know, you guys being very down to earth and being like, you know, being quite often quite self-effacing, is there a point where you were like, yeah, this is our fucking life now? Like, was there a moment where it switched in your brain? You're like, now I've done this, that means that basically we're set up and this is just going to be our job forever now. Do you remember a point?
Well, the first time, I'd given them a notice at work and I went to Glasgow to support the Specials. Wow. And we started doing a tour with them. And so I checked into the hotel and I got into the room and put my case on the floor and it suddenly hit me that this was now my new job. And I just took it as just another job.
Yeah.
I didn't see past that. Yeah. But when I stopped drinking and when I stopped taking drugs and became a lot happier, then it turned into something else. It turned into the dream job I wanted, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, I like myself now and I like myself in this. And, you know, I like applying myself to this and we're quite successful and I liked it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But before that, it was just, it's just a fucking job, isn't it? Just getting, all right, I'm in the papers and like, you know, there's people that I've known most of my life who just thought I wasn't going anywhere, now just are speechless, you know? And then, a lot of people getting in touch with you on Facebook who you know just fucking hated you. Oh, hello, mate. Even people from school. Oh, do you want to go for a coffee? What the fuck for? It's like, when was the last time I saw you? You absolute wanker. Absolute fucking arsehole. So it's like, no. So yeah, that was great. Yeah. But it was clear that by the age of 32, 43, I needed to stop drinking and taking drugs. It was not working anymore. And I had kids as well. And it was like, this ain't right, you know. So,
it's funny that, because I think obviously people like think, oh yeah, kids will sort of settle everything down. But quite often it goes the other way, doesn't it? Like a lot of people feel like they you need it more, like you need the sort of relief and stuff. And I can only imagine, you know, becoming a pop star, inverted commas, at that time.
Could
be very, very dangerous, as it were, like, you know.
Well, it was, because you had money, and it was like, you don't have to owe dealers, you know, you don't get any horrible voice recordings, you know, voice messages. Where are you? Yeah, come round for me money. Yeah, come round tomorrow for me money. All right, bye. You know what I mean? None of that anymore. It was like cash is on the table, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it took a while, but yeah, I got out of it with obviously the help of my wife. Yeah. It was just fantastic. You know, she was brilliant.
That's really great.
Mm.
Amazing.
I know, obviously, they're very young, but your nine-year-old daughter, does she have any awareness of Sleaford Mods?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And what does she make of it all?
All you care about is your phone daddy in Sleaford Mods. That's all you care about. That's all you care about.
Pretty devastating. I feel like she's got you there.
Big time. It's like, all right. No, she's, I don't even know. I think they know about it, both of them, but I don't think they figured out that it's not your usual run of the mill job.
Yeah. Should we get on to your album that you are going to be talking about, introducing us to? Every episode we ask our guests to bring an album to the club. Which one
You
brought, Jason?
I've bought From the Double Gone Chapel by the Two Lone Swordsmen.
Yes. This was a new one on me, like, completely. I know Andrew Weatherall, whose project it is.
Yeah. Keith
Tenniswood.
Yeah.
So name. Talk us through this. Like, where did it... It feels like it's 2004, which is around the sort of time that... Was it that around the time that Sleaford Mods was kind of solidifying into a project?
Yeah,
a little bit. 2003, we started around 2004 or 2005, or rather I did. But I'd heard this, a friend of mine was playing it in the shop he worked in. We all worked in clothes shops around that period still.
I saw another thing where you're saying you're into your clothes as well.
Right, so it was kind of like towards the end of that golden period of retail, do you know what I mean? Sort of 2000, mid-2000s. Going up a little bit more, perhaps, but I went into his shop and he was banging it out, and I was like, "Oh, what's this?" You know, and got into it, and used it as a point of reference, as the guidebook. Yeah. Really, I hadn't really heard much like it before. Obviously, the rumbling bass reminded me of some of the old punk stuff I was into, but it was just the nihilism in it. The it's quite dystopian as well. Really cynical and really claustrophobic. And I thought it was completely and utterly modern.
Club.
I mean, I know Keith Tenniswood a bit now, and he was sending me some of the stuff that he was influenced by when he recorded this, and it's all Brian Eno and stuff like that. And I mean, that's just not on my radar.
Right. But, so was it a bit of a gateway as well in terms of like?
Yeah, sure. Really. I just took that bass on board and. You know, that heavy rumbling bass sound and some of the sound effects on there, the fire alarms, there's obviously a little bit of a punk aesthetic with it as well. I use that as my my Bible, so to speak, moving forward, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can definitely hear, there's a similar... Yeah, as you say, claustrophobia, and there's a kind of imposing sort of chug to it, and like the lyrics are quite It's all quite dense and knotty, like, which is like really great. And it really did remind me of that moment when you would get like electro and like indie and dance music sort of sat side by side, and it sort of predates all that kind of new rave palaver and all that.
Yeah, sure, but it really reminds
me of that. You know, Joe and I at that time, you know, we'd be at sort of indie discos and stuff, and we'd probably be hearing stuff like this and not really know what it was, but it was, it did feel like a really specific moment, and Weatherall was such a huge part of that in particular, and yeah, these guys clearly were. So yeah, thanks for introducing us to it. I absolutely love it.
Absolutely, no problem. Oh yeah, it's just brilliant.
Bit of sex beat.
Like it's, I think sex beat is great. But I feel like it's also a good, like, I feel like you can see this in so many other people's work.
Mm.
Like having heard it for the first time this weekend, I was like,
yeah,
oh, people that I thought had created that sound have clearly just listened to some Two Lone Swordsmen stuff at points. So influential to a lot of bands and projects, and then you just think, oh, I didn't even know.
This
is I really get into that, the whole idea of the people that kind of set scenes or the people that kind of etch out directions for generations to come are the ones that suffer the most because they aren't necessarily in the public eye. But I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't think they want it to be for a start, but it's they just love the idea of making music, you know.
And this was, I mean, I've read a bit about it, and this was a bit of a like hard left turn for them in terms of, I think it's sort of like divided the fan base, as it were, to a degree. Like, it was a lot darker and a bit more abrasive than what they had been doing. And when you think of the sort of indie electro of the time, it was maybe a bit more user friendly. And that seems like something that you've kind of maybe taken into your music in terms and your sort of sensibility as well. That you're not afraid to go for it in terms of darker places and sort of challenging.
No. Oh, absolutely not. I think when the ideas come, and you always hope they do come, the inspiration, do you know what I mean? If that comes, then you try and incorporate that into whatever you're doing, because I couldn't think of anything worse than just repeating ourselves, you know. I'm sure Andrew would feel the same, you know what I mean? I mean, there are some like trademark tracks on each album or whatever, simply because I just love it. But the fact is, you've got to... I personally think you have to keep etching away at it. And I'm not just talking, oh, the law is changing, because a lot of bands that say that aren't, you know, it's bullshit. Yeah. But it's like, you've got to sort of fuck around with the mold of it a bit. But also listening to music, listening to other people's music, being a bit more open-minded is a real important aspect of inspiration, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good point.
I also really like about this album, like, the mix of songs that are just purely instrumental. Like, Damp is a song I listened to that about 3 or 4 times and just sort of went off in my own little world over it. And it's like...
Yes, wicked. Yeah, that's all you've got to like. That primarily, and The Lurch, and former Kurt
Fuego. Yeah, that was great.
Oh, they are... Those really did stick out as you know, sort of key tracks with that kind of bass orientation, you know what I mean? But I mean, even Stack It Up, the first tune, it's just so cheeky. And there was Weatherall had a bit of a reputation back in the past, you know, being a bit aloof or whatever. Quite fucking rightly so, you know. It's like, in a world of shit, you know what I mean? It's like, when things stick out, why shouldn't be proud of it, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think him and Keith were, I speak to Keith a bit, and Keith is not like that.
Always. Have you met Weatherall as well? Have you encountered him?
Yeah, a couple of times, And, you know, but yeah, I mean, that really influenced me, really inspired me. Just not just the record, but the personalities as well.
I
got to say as well, the notion of like being introduced to things being played in shops by like, you know, people that are a bit in the know is like a real time capsule and like really important. And I would hear so many things that way as well. And like, You know, I worked in clothes shops as well. Joe, I don't think you did clothes shops, did you?
I was in Pizza Hut, but I didn't really get a choice over the playlist in there. I didn't really get to choose what they were listening to. God, but yeah, there was no chance of like putting any Busta Rhymes on the Pizza Hut playlist, you know?
I bet with those places are sent in, aren't they? The music's 100% in from their office. Yeah.
And Christmas music starts like, I know it's a cliche, but literally starts like the last day of August.
Oh, fucking don't.
You did spend a lot of time, like I feel like you spent a lot of your kind of career of interviews just kind of recounting the various jobs you've had.
Were there any
like that were surprisingly that you kind of quite enjoyed, like more than you'd have thought, or places that you sort of look back on with a weird sort of fondness, or was it all just drudgery?
Mostly the ones that weren't viewed as, you know, clothes shops were viewed as jobs for anyone that was unskilled or wanted to be cool.
Clothes shop was
the one, you know what I mean? It's like, oh yeah. But I really enjoyed shit like warehouses and working in, I worked in a little chef room.
Amazing.
I really enjoyed that.
In the kitchen or serving, or do you have to do
both? Oh, in the kitchen. I was in the kitchen. It was terrible. Oh, wow. I was absolutely terrible. I was okay at cooking, but I'd never washed my hands. I was like, oh, it's terrible. So, I got in there, joined there, and was this Polish lady, I forgot her name now, but she showed me the ropes and then she left. But she cooked so fast, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And but you just took your mind off the absolute collapsing walls that at the time was my existence. It was good. It was all right.
While we're on jobs, one of my favourite ever Sleaford songs is "The Mekon," and I just wondered, is that directly, because I've known about that song for a long time, but I only, in doing the research for this interview, found out that you actually worked in a chicken factory.
Yes.
So is that directly influenced by that experience?
Yeah, of course.
That sounds like an absolutely horrific job.
Oh, it was terrible, but there were variations of it, you know, varying levels, much like Dante's Inferno. There were varying levels of hell, you know what I mean? And, it was bad. Yeah, it was pretty bad. But that was written around the time I was working in a cold store, taking temperatures of chicken.
Right, yeah.
I think I'd written Job Seeker around that period as well. But it was just me and another Polish guy sat in the canteen pretty much throughout the day, because you only got two deliveries a day. And so you'd spend 10 minutes taking the temperature of whatever they brought in and then go back to the canteen. It was insanity. And you never had any money, so you couldn't even smoke, you know. And it was like, oh, we got a fag. No, you didn't ask people for fags after a while, you know. It was pretty bad.
No one had one.
Well, they just said people just would not give you a cigarette, you know. So it's those songs were written around that period.
I wonder, and you've spoken about this like really eloquently, both on songs and in interviews, the kind of this notion of like class tourism and some of the kind of acts that kind of outfit themselves or costume themselves in sort of gear and working classes.
Yeah.
It's a charge that's been levelled at you guys to a degree that you're not sort of gritty or real enough in some way. Which is insane. It just shows the madness of it. I wondered how has your sort of approach with that kind of thing evolved or changed throughout the years, and talking about it and constantly being asked about it? And I wonder if in some ways, and I kind of feel this sometimes as, you know, when you're representing, say, a culture or a part of a minority, as it were, in some ways, and you're kind of called upon to talk about them, and you're a bit like, oh, do you know, like you're sort of almost being the tour guide, as it were, like in terms of you're helping other people on their kind of class tour. How do you feel about that?
I think it's kind of a really complicated issue, isn't it? It's not just black and white. But, I mean, I find that all of my contemporaries have accents that I would attribute to a middle-class person, you know what I mean? But that necessarily might not be the case, you know. I think there's a lot of working-class people that gentrify their accents subconsciously and act in a way that isn't that doesn't mirror their roots or their background, you know. And I think a lot of that is done subconsciously, again, because it's nobody wants a coarse person in the room. Nobody wants a coarse accent. You know what I mean? Yeah. Nobody wants somebody that sounds like they've just walked out of a shed in the room. It's just not going to work, is it? It's like, no, we don't want that. No. So it's, I think there's a lot of that, but which is, you know, it's like, you know, I don't care where you're from, you know, but if you're gonna sort of allude to being a part of a landscape that you're not and you know nothing about, and you're using that to promote the image of your creative project, that really winds me up. It's like, what are you fucking doing? You know what I mean? It's like, you can't stand outside of a high rise looking really fucking like Mad Max, you know, like some facial expression like it's the end of the world in a tracksuit with tattoos on your neck, alluding to a person that you would generally connect with a high rise. Let's face the facts, you know what I mean? Yeah. When you're not like that, when I know you're fucking not like that, so what are you doing, you know? Yeah. And it's like
I feel like coming from, like mainly I would kind of class myself as working class because of my old man more than like the conditions I was brought up in. And obviously, like I said to you when we first come on, you said, where are you? And I said, like, a massive slice of luck to be living in, like, the hipster bit of East London. So it's like, I would feel very strange. Like, I do talk about it, but I also am aware that, like, people might not see me in that way. And so then I actually have doubts about it. And I do genuinely, authentically think that I am qualified to talk about it. But I think it's tricky. Whereas these people that aren't really from that background, they don't have any qualms with using it to make a bit of money. Do you know what I mean?
I think there's a lot of it. People aren't aware of it. You know, I think bands that I've come across, I don't think they do it on purpose. I just think they're not aware of it. It's not a conscious thing. Yeah. They just don't get it, which in turn makes me even more angry because a lot of these bands are fronting sort of social issue songs. You know what I mean? And talking about like the plight of the ordinary person, and yet they're running around in fucking, you know, Mr. Blobby costumes. You know what I mean? It's like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, you're not a Jew. You're not, mate. Yeah. You need to stop that. You know, I mean, it's even I'm a little bit like, I come from a working class background, and it hasn't left me to a certain degree. There's lots of traits that have stayed with me since birth. But I wouldn't fucking stand outside an high rise. I would even worry about wearing a pair of jogging bottoms, you know, a pair of Nike jogging bottoms, because it's like, I don't come from really that kind of landscape. Okay, you know, but, you know, and you wrestle with yourself, and it's like, perhaps some people ain't bothered, you know, people ain't bothered. Yeah. But at the same time, it's I'm really, you know, quite, I take it really seriously. You know what I mean? It's like if you're into hip hop, it's like and rap and stuff like that. God, you got really treat it with respect. Yeah. You know, 100%. You know, absolutely. And it's like, okay, so I really love this, but I can put this in my stuff.
Yeah,
and you just tailor it to who you are. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to say the same message. And this is where people fall down, you know.
Yeah.
I'm fucking went out, fucking beat someone. No, you didn't. You didn't, mate. I know you didn't. You know what I mean? It's not hard to beat. My point is really is that why can't you be creative? You know, it's like, why can't you think about who you are? Just because you're from a middle-class area, a suburban area, doesn't mean you're any less interesting than someone from a working-class area.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why can't you just hone into that and create a message from that instead of pretending to be Lemmy or pretending to be fucking, do you know, pretending to be Skepta? Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not working. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
As you said that, I was thinking of Weller, who I know that you were, you know, we mentioned earlier, is like a fan. You know, he's from the suburbs, and he kind of spoke to people that were from the suburbs as well, didn't he? And was kind of maybe like sneered at to a degree by the kind of
a little bit, yeah.
That were kind of, you know, properly in town, well, as it were, and in the scene.
Well, he was like he came out and supported the Conservative Party, didn't he, back in 77, like an idiot.
Did it?
I don't think he knew what he was on about, really. And he admits that now, you know. But I don't know, it's a real tough one. But I can't sit there and go, all right, I'm going to shoot my mouth because I sound like a bitter old man, you know. It's like, I'm not going to do that. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm going to be a bitter old man and I'm going to say it anyway. So.
Amazing.
Just as this is obviously going to come out right around the time that the album comes out, is there anything that you would like to talk about the album before we wrap up with you today? Because it's great that we're going to be able to put this out at the same time as the release of the album. So I just wondered, as it's in that period where you're waiting for it to happen a little bit at the moment, kind of what are your... Are you the kind of person that has kind of hopes and aspirations for it, or are you like... I've done it, I'm happy with it, whatever it does, and then I'll move on to the next thing. How are you feeling about it all?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, yeah, it's really hard because I'm that close to it, and sometimes, I'm, you know, people, we're not the best to ask, are we? It's like, yeah, really what I want to say to you is that I'm worried people are just sick of us. I feel too old, and you know what I mean? Am I too, you know, I feel like an imposter because I'm 50. And people are just fucking sick of us. We've been around for 10 years. But the positive side of me is saying that it's another strong album. Me and Andrew are really happy with it. And, you know, there ain't a, you know, we're still on our own, you know what I mean? We're sort of on our own little island and the quality's still there, you know what I mean? I think it always will be. It will just be a case of, whenever we decide to stop, then that will stop. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've only had a chance to listen to it about 3 times, but I think it is such a good album.
Thank you very much.
Really impressed. And yeah, I mean,
thank you very much.
It's funny. I appreciate you being that honest, because it must be what so many people think, because it's what all of us think if we do any sort of job or creative project or whatever. You're like, I've absolutely lost it. This is like, you know, but it's it's kind of like, it's part of your appeal, I think, as well, that you are kind of honest and frank about these things, and that it is that, you know, even being honest about your age, like, you know, to be honest, like, there's a lot of acts that would probably be like, oh, yeah, I won't just say. We've even got mates who shave a couple of years off their age. You know, we're in our mid 30s.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I always get this vision of like just throwing rotten veg at people that do that. Do you know what I mean? She's like, wanker, like a bit of veg smacks them in the face. You know what I mean? It's like, oh no. I think, but also that fuels what we do, particularly in the lyrics. Yeah. It's like, Oh, fuck it. I'm just going to write another song. And that in itself just fuels the right kind of energy that you want in stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. But I think it's like that lack of sheen and like the sort of like brutally honest perspective and the realism means that you can easily, like, no one gives a fuck what age sleeper mods are because they know that they're a real thing. Whereas someone who's maybe being a bit glossy and a bit, do you know what I mean, fake or whatever, now they look too old to be doing that because, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
With you guys, yeah, it doesn't matter because it's not ever been about that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have said
that. No, it hasn't. You know, I mean, you just carry on. It's like, well, it's fucking...
Until the next album and the David Guetta collaboration...
Oh, could you imagine that?
That would really shock some heads. That would really sort of... that would really mess with people. But,
so our manager's like, you know, when you start moaning about, oh, why's that band got there and we haven't? It's like, well, you can do that if you want, Jason. But you know what you have to do in order to do that, don't you? What? You have to be like that. Could you be like that? No, I couldn't. Yeah. Well then, shut the fuck up.
Amazing. I can't think of a better note to end on, unless you've got anything else, Joe.
No, I was just going to ruin it with a comedy question about spare ribs, to be honest. But I
think... brilliant. Spare ribs. What do you want? You know, like when you get to the Chinese with your family, and you sit around and like there'd always be another family next door fighting with each other, and there'd be spare ribs and egg fried rice all over the place. Just brilliant. Fucking.
Yeah, I've got one other quick question. You know, on Tap Room, who's talking about making knickers?
Oh, that's Lisa McKenzie. Dr. Lisa McKenzie, I might add. She is she's like a professor in working class culture and working class history. Oh, I've known Lisa for years. When she worked in closed shops along with me. And I think the first ever thing she said to me was to someone else, "Why are you talking to that cunt?" That's how you can imagine. So that's Lisa in a nutshell. But she's absolutely a really lovely woman, intelligent woman, and someone that's got a real good slant, a very different slant, I think, on class in the country in a lot of respects. It's always quite interesting talking to her. So I sort of asked her if she'd do a little bit of a monologue for the album, and she sent back a 2-minute thing, which it was great, but I just wanted the last three lines, well, there's two or three lines in there that summed it all up, you know. I love that on the front of the record.
Great.
It's the top.
It's great. It's another sort of way that it feels different, like, you know, the kind of opening up to like collaborations and different voices, really, which, you know,
is
really nice.
We wanted to try and definitely try and spread it out a bit more, you know. But and I think, you know, Spear Ribs has done that. It's shown us that there's more room, you know, we've made more room for ourselves, so to speak. And very good.
Great stuff. Well, listen, man, like, congratulations. It's such a good album, and it's been like such a pleasure to have you on the podcast and to get to chat to you for such a long time. So thanks for doing it.
Yeah,
it's been a blast.
Thanks for your time. It's been really great.
Thanks for inviting me.
JJ's Album Club. So there we have it. That is our fantastic interview with Jason Williamson. I hope you enjoyed that. Please remember to like, rate and subscribe. We're really trying to go all guns blazing at this new series to enable us to keep doing future series. It's free. All we need you to do is like, rate and subscribe. Next week on the podcast, we have got an interview with Sports Team. Really wonderful. I keep saying they're wonderful, but they're all so good. This whole series, we're so proud of it. And another great chat next week where Sports Team will be revealing one of their favourite albums. From me and from Jimmy, that's it for this week. See you next time on JJ's Album Club!